From KUT News and the Texas Tribune, this is The Ticket.
We demand our liberty.
That American dream is pivotal for the future of our country.
Americans have come back from some pretty tough economic times.
But we can and must do better.
And we are going to make our country great again.
I'm Ben Philpott.
And I'm Jay Root.
This week on the show, we've had another horrific mass shooting. And of course, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton had something to say about it.
So we'll bring back out the Stump Interrupted segment to dissect what they said and talk about how it might play in the 2016 election.
Also from the candidates, Hillary Clinton says Texas is in play in the 2016 election. Really?
What? To help us figure out just how realistic that actually is, we'll talk with Democratic strategist Colin Strother. He'll help us break down exactly what Democrats think could happen in Texas with Trump at the top of the ticket.
But first, Jay, we've had a couple of new polls out this week, and they show for the moment that Hillary Clinton is starting to widen her lead over Donald Trump. Obviously, both, you know, the polls we've seen were taken before Orlando. We don't know how that will play into future polls, but a poll by Bloomberg yesterday saying 12-point lead now for Hillary Clinton.
Well, and this came out after the brouhaha over his comments about the federal judge saying that he was, quote, a Mexican, even though actually he was born in this country and he's not a Mexican, is of Mexican-American or is of Mexican heritage.
And therefore he couldn't do his job as a judge.
Right. And that, you know,
because Trump's building a wall. Which is about as specific as he got in that whole tirade, other than this guy can't be my judge. The only real why, you know, that he gave was, well, because I'm building a wall.
Right. Well, I think one columnist said, so like anybody who is offended by his remarks, you know, so if he offends someone, then they're biased against him. I mean, where does that stop? You know, how far do you go with that kind of reasoning? But aside from that, this was a moment where you had the Speaker of the House calling him out and saying it was textbook racist comment. And there, you know, I started looking at it. I was like, God, this is really hitting the point where you could see the dump Trump movement at the convention really taking off. I think that the Orlando attacks have just put a chill on everything and have reshuffled the deck, and nobody's talking about the judge anymore. I mean, I think that it's so horrible to even talk about these kinds of things helping or hurting somebody
because
this was a horrible tragedy, obviously, the worst mass shooting in American history. But it did, full stop, but it, you know, it did, I think, reshuffle the deck for Trump, and nobody's talking about the earlier controversy, which I think really threatened to hurt his candidacy in a way that, you know, that deal almost a fatal blow to his candidacy.
I think, you know, in talking about shuffling the deck for the convention, I was telling someone yesterday, I thought that if the Stop Trump movement could get three polls in a row that say Trump is losing by 15 points, that would be the ammo that they take to the convention to try and write the rules, to try and unbind the delegates, to try and nominate someone else.
Yeah, you know, I think it's looking,
not that that's a good chance.
Right.
But if you had three polls in a row that said 15% or greater, he's losing, I think that would, at the very least, give them more credibility heading into that rules meeting.
Yeah, you know, again, you say, what's it going to take? I mean, you know, you have this unusual specter that we've seen, you know, on our last program when we talked with Michael Quinn Sullivan, a very well-known conservative activist in Texas. And, you know, we asked him, like, what's it going to take, I mean, for you to feel okay about somebody who keeps doing these kinds of things over and over again? And I noticed that Sullivan tweeted about the judge thing and was critical of Trump on that. So you just keep having people that on all sides of the Republican spectrum, they're just like, I cannot swallow this. I just can't. I can't do this.
At least 49 people were killed at a gay nightclub in Orlando early on the morning of June 12th. Unfortunately, whenever you're listening to this podcast, that number could be higher. And as you've already been told, it was the deadliest mass shooting in modern U.S. history.
And it didn't take long for the expected Republican and Democratic presidential nominees to give long speeches about what they would do as president to prevent future shootings.
So today we'll put those speeches from Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton to the test on Stump Interrupted. We'll start with the big points that each made on how to stop future attacks. First up, GOP candidate Donald Trump, who says it's not about guns, it's about who's shooting them.
She wants to take away Americans' guns and then admit the very people who want to slaughter us. Let them come into the country. We don't have guns. Let them come in. Let them have all the fun they want. America has already admitted four times more immigrants than any country on earth, anybody in the world, four times more, at least, because we don't even know who's coming in. And we continue to admit millions more with no real checks or scrutiny.
So, of course, Trump's answer, and this is something he said from pretty much day one of his campaign, do at the very least a temporary ban on Muslims who are coming from countries that have terrorist activity. These are the comments that have gotten him into trouble with a lot of people, obviously.
Which he wears like a badge of honor, I'm guessing. You know, I mean, this, I have to wonder, again, you know, it's delicate to talk about how a tragedy is going to impact someone politically. However, I have to wonder if this does not actually help Donald Trump. I mean, do you wonder that?
I don't know. I think that this may be going too far.
Oh, yeah. I mean, but, you know, of course, I mean,
right,
that
of course
Donald
it's going
Trump
too far.
Has made a career out of going too far. But
I think that,
you know, we've been wrong before, too, about when he's gone too far and thinking, oh, but I thought that when he criticized John McCain, a legitimate war hero who spent years in a concentration camp, basically, in Vietnam, that was going too far. It didn't hurt him. It didn't hurt him at all. It helped him, probably.
I will say the one difference now is that he, you know, we saw some Republican elected officials kind of jump in and say, no, wait a minute, John McCain's a great American. But it seems like the response from elected Republicans now has been a little stronger. And even their non-responses are stronger. They're just saying, you know what? I'm not going to talk about this guy
right.
anymore.
Right. Well, and I think that what you're looking at here, too, is that what happens after a tragedy usually is that there's at least a few days of, you know, this is a horrible thing and I'm praying for the victims and all that. And we went straight to the invective on this. I mean, yep. I think that's what some people, you know, that's what really stood out to me about this is, again, Donald Trump is not a typical candidate. This is not a typical year, a presidential year. So things are going to be different. But that's what stood out to me was that the rush toward taking a political advantage from something, of course, and you know, people have accused Hillary Clinton of doing the same thing about an assault weapons ban.
Well, that leads us right into the first. This was the big idea, the big takeaway from Hillary's speech on Monday, the day after the attack, which is, that she's focusing on the guns.
Even as we make sure our security officials get the tools they need to prevent attacks, it's essential that we stop terrorists from getting the tools they need to carry out the attacks. And that is especially true when it comes to assault weapons like those used in Orlando and San Bernardino.
Honestly, I would say that Hillary Clinton could also is risk being criticized for rushing too quickly to talk about guns. I mean, and again, whether warranted or not, it's remarkable how the climate that we're in right now is so heated, and you know, a tragedy happens and we've immediately gone to the political. You sense that something really has changed in our politics.
Well, it just seems like it seems like there are never any solutions that 70 to 80% of the country can get behind.
Right.
You know, if one of these candidates were putting forward a solution that 70 to 80% of the country said, yes, that's you know, whether it's a silver bullet or not, it's a step in the right direction. Then I think.
Well, I've got one. I've got one that may. That I'd like to see what the poll on this is. Should somebody on a terror watch list be able to walk into a gun shop and get an assault rifle? And I heard CNN, a guy from a gun shop owner was quoted as saying, "No, if you're on a terror watch list, you shouldn't be able to get a gun." I mean, so you know, maybe that's a common sense solution here that could bring some people together. I mean, I know a lot of conservatives who would probably be okay with that.
All right, now let's dive down a little more into Trump's call to ban Muslims from countries with terrorist activities. First up, we're going to hear Clinton reiterating a line that President Obama has used before, which is that focusing on a terrorist's religious ties doesn't actually help the war on terror.
And as the director of the FBI has pointed out, we should avoid eroding trust in that community, which will only make law enforcement's job more difficult. Inflammatory anti-Muslim rhetoric and threatening to ban the families and friends of Muslim Americans, as well as millions of Muslim business people and tourists, hurts the vast majority of Muslims who love freedom and hate terror.
So that's the line from Clinton, also the line that we heard from a obviously agitated, some have said pissed off, President Obama when he gave a speech also this week responding to Donald Trump's ban on Muslims entering the country. It has been interesting. I've heard multiple security experts, former national security directors or assistant directors or whatever, on NPR and papers across the country all saying, you know, yeah, we can't single out a religion when we're talking about this. Although I did hear I saw something very interesting. I saw a good kind of counterpoint, but another way of saying it, which is, how do we think Christians would feel if every time we mentioned a KKK member or a neo-Nazi as saying that they are an extremist Christian?
And again, here's where, you know, I guess there's no place for common sense, but it would seem to me that at some point in this war on radical Islamic terrorists, that we're going to need nations where there's a majority of Muslims, right? So going to those countries and saying we're going to ban you and your family and the leaders and everyone in your country from coming to our country doesn't seem like a good talking point in terms of getting the negotiations started on how you're going to help us.
Staying on this theme, we're going to hit Trump, you know, doubling down here on Muslim immigrants, saying that people who are already in the country, maybe people who are second or third generation Muslims in the country, aren't doing enough to help stop these lone wolf attackers.
The Muslim community, so importantly, they have to work with us. They have to cooperate with law enforcement and turn in the people who they know are bad. And they know it. And they have to do it, and they have to do it forthwith.
And before we jump into that one, here's one final cut from Trump. Here is another reason why he wants to ban Muslims from the country.
Altogether, under the Clinton plan, you'd be admitting hundreds of thousands of refugees from the Middle East with no system to vet them, or to prevent the radicalization of the children and their children. Not only their children, by the way, they're trying to take over our children and convince them how wonderful ISIS is and how wonderful Islam is, and we don't know what's happening.
I will say just real quickly, there at the very end, I think we hear a little bit of the dog whistle that some people feel like this entire argument is about, which is the idea of the Islamic religion growing in the United States and one day taking over what we are at the moment, which is a majority Christian country.
Well, there's a lot of dog whistles, that's for sure.
Well, finally, let's move on to our last cut from Clinton. This is one thing that she says she would do to get better intelligence, better tracking of any kind of terrorist threats that are going on in the country, and that is the better tracking of social media.
This is something I spent a lot of time on at the State Department. As president, I will work with our great tech companies from Silicon Valley to Boston to step up our game. We have to do a better job intercepting ISIS's communications.
You know, privacy issues and terrorism have been, you know, beating each other up since right after 9/11, since the Patriot Act. And I think it'll be interesting to see, you know, that may be one of, other than people who are against any gun regulations being extremely mad at Hillary for putting forward any kind of gun restriction laws. I think that may be the part of the speech that gets the most blowback, is the idea of figuring out through the people that are creating the social media platforms how to better monitor what's being said.
Again, this is one of those areas where I just wonder if, you know, it's not too big of an area to even control. I mean, you just imagine how much social media is out there. It's like a needle in a haystack sometimes. I mean, it always seems easy, like, oh my God, why didn't somebody look at his Facebook post? But how many Facebook posts are there, you know? Or why didn't somebody, you know, keep up with this guy and what he was doing? But there's so many people that need surveillance that, you know, in retrospect, it's easy to think, oh, well, why weren't we looking at this person? But I just don't know how much of an answer that is. As we said at the top of the show, Hillary Clinton has been quoted as saying, Texas, the state of Texas is in play, meaning Texas is a state that she thinks she might have a shot to win.
But that may come as a surprise to Texas Democrats, since the state hasn't been in play really for a Democratic presidential candidate since 1992, and not for a statewide Democrat since Governor Ann Richards lost her reelection bid to George W. Bush in 1994.
So to find out what Democrats on the ground here in Texas really think is happening, we turn to Democratic strategist Colin Strother. Colin, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Hillary Clinton says Texas is in play. This is going to be multiple choice. Did you roll your eyes? Did you slap your forehead? Or did you say, damn right, when you heard her say that?
It was a combination.
Of all three?
The Texas will be in play as soon as we put it in play. When the Democratic National Committee and our presidential nominee puts $100 million over 4 years, like Obama did in Ohio, guess what? Texas won't be in play. It'll be solidly blue, and it will probably stay that way. But until we invest in a real way and we provide the professional expertise and the ground troops and the cash that we need, it won't be in play. So it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. If she wants it to be in play and the DNC wants it to be in play, then they can put it in play. Write us a check.
And so, and the reason you feel like you can say that is because you do believe that there are untapped voters here, untapped potential.
There are unmotivated voters. Let's go back.
Because you're not assuming that people who are currently voting Republican are going to flip their vote.
Not necessarily. I do think that some of them will.
Right.
If presented but with an exciting alternative.
In terms of the state turning, of the state turning blue, you're looking at this from a untapped potential as opposed to a flipping the vote.
To a large extent, yes. Yeah. I'd say probably an 8-1 in that regard. Let's go back to day after the election, November 2008. We are about 400 votes in the Metroplex in a state rep race from taking back the speaker's gavel in Texas. In 2008, it wasn't because our ground game suddenly improved. It wasn't because we got a lot better at what we were doing. It's because we had a candidate at the top of the ticket that inspired people to go vote. The DNC didn't invest in Texas in the general election. The presidential candidate didn't invest in Texas. What he did is he inspired people to go vote. And so that's what we've got to do. We've got to run passionate candidates that inspire passion in the voters.
You know, if you do even do like really well and make it very close, the Democrats are going to look really stupid because they left a lot of these down ballot races without candidates in them. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. And, you know, again, I'll hearken back to 2008. You know, Bob Romano, his name should be inscribed on the wall of the state party headquarters. Bob Romano had never been contacted by anybody with a state party. They didn't know how to get a hold of him to see if he needed help.
This is the one that lost by.
This is the one that lost by a few hundred votes and cost us a speaker's chair in 2008. So, yeah, it's a run everywhere strategy. The Republicans have been really good at it. That's how they took the Texas Senate. In 2004, they recruited a no-name nerdy CPA from Carthage, Texas, Center Texas, to run for state Senate. Bill Haley resigns midterm. Curtis Swallow gets appointed. TLR gets their first big win. They take over the Senate. So the run everywhere strategy there's a lot of value to it. It gives you options. A precursor to getting elected is being on the ballot. If you're not on the ballot, there's no way you're going to win. So first things first, we got to run everywhere every time.
What are you hearing on the ground from your clients, from the people out there that are running, and in terms of how big of a deal the Trump factor is in some of these races, and you know, hanging that on the heads of the Republican candidates? Is that happening?
It is to some extent. I think it will develop a little more, particularly as we get through the Republicans' National Convention, and some of the nominating speeches are going to be what they're going to be. And, you know, Trump's going to go off script like he's, you know, prone to do, and we'll see kind of what happens there. Where Democrats really started getting beat in Texas is with the Chamber of Commerce Republicans. The Chamber of Commerce Republicans in the early to mid-90s started going over to George W. Bush and businessman David Dewhurst. They started migrating over to the Republican Party. It wasn't the evangelicals driving it so much as the mainstream Chamber of Commerce Republicans. Donald Trump doesn't appeal to them. Based on the ones that I've spoken to, I'm not seeing the laziest form of activism is on social media, and I'm not seeing the normal people doing that. But even at the institutional level, you have Texans, prominent Texans like George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush, that are declining to get involved. When in the past they've, you know, circled the wagons when it was time and done their duty and endorsed the right person. And this time they're choosing to stay out of it. And I think there's going to be a lot of Republicans that are splitting their ticket. Maybe in a protest vote, maybe because they want to support a libertarian candidate. You know, once we get them to split their ticket, we got to crack at a few of them at least.
You know, the state Republicans, especially under Steve Munisteri, spent lots of money, lots of effort trying to reach out to Hispanics. We've had in the last few years things like the Hispanic Republicans of Texas come on, you know, George P. Bush, others pushing the party. Then you had the Governor Abbott getting, 50% of the male Hispanic vote in the last in the gubernatorial election.
Correct.
A lot of people have said that this campaign, though, this Trump campaign, may kind of press the reset button on that, that they've built all this up and now someone like Trump could knock it all down. What if this is a second chance for Democrats at that slice of Texas? Are there things that they did wrong over the last 20 years that they got to get right now if they're getting a second shot?
Absolutely. Particularly with Hispanic voters, you can't treat them like an ATM, that when you need them, you walk over and push a few buttons and, you know, it gives you what you need and you turn and walk off. And that's how the party's treated Hispanic voters. The way that you see that manifested is in Democratic primaries, all these border counties and South Texas counties have huge turnout. Webb County, for instance, most Hispanic county in the country, nearly 50% turnout in a primary election. And then in a general, it's in the low 30s. No one's talking to them. No one's spending money there. No one's making sure that they're getting petitioning for extra early voting hours, weekend early voting, mobile early voting, things like that. So the Democratic Party has got to accept that this is a critical constituency and we need to treat them as such. It's not that rural white former Democrats in East Texas don't have value, but it's they're much higher fruit on the tree to go and get. We have literally millions of Hispanics that agree with us on virtually every issue. They just need to be motivated to go out and vote.
Well, do you think they also need to be reminded of what those Democratic issues are? I mean, in terms of instead of just saying, well, you know, you're with us, so please vote, going to them and as if they were never with you in the first place, saying, here is where we have this common, here's where we agree on things.
You know, I actually don't. Okay. I don't think that's nearly as important as showing them a picture of the alternative.
Donald Trump. So it's all about I'm not that guy.
Here's what they want to do to you.
Right.
Fear and loathing is a much stronger motivating factor than joy. So just saying, hey, I'm a nice guy. Come vote for me. It's not nearly as motivating as this guy's going to burn your house down. He's going to take people you know. He's going to load them on a bus, and he's going to ship them back to wherever they came from. Regardless of their age, regardless of their contribution to society. He doesn't think they even deserve to be here. He doesn't think that your school should be funded the same as everyone else's. He doesn't think that you should have the same opportunity to enter the country as people from other countries that can invest $500,000 in a business and automatically jump the line. And your grandfather or your father or your cousin that came here and fought and clawed for years so you could live the American dream, he doesn't just think they should go back. He thinks you should go back too.
So tell me if you think I'm wrong, but doesn't that sound like a one election strategy instead of a moving the state to a blue state strategy?
You know, as long as the Republicans keep throwing hanging curveballs, we ought to keep hitting them out of the park. As long as they continue to go after, these really non-issues, sanctuary cities, anchor babies, dreamers, top 10% rule, as long as they keep throwing us hanging curves, we ought to keep swinging at them. And they've not shown a propensity yet to run one cycle hate campaigns. I mean, they're making it part of their recipe book.
Well, to me, it sounds like, you know, this election is shaping up as sort of a rare example of the shoe being on the other foot, because for years, Democrats have been saddled with nominees, presidential nominees, that in Texas didn't play too well. I mean, you know, George McGovern didn't play too well. Bill Clinton didn't play too well, obviously, although I went back and looked, and in 1992, it was like a 3-point race between him and George H.W. Bush, because Ross Perot got over, I think he got 21% or something like that of the vote in Texas. It was 19 nationally. But, you know, is this sort of like, you know, looking at... You know, is this what the Democrats sort of, I mean, have been saddled with for years, is nominees that you had to kind of run away from?
You know, we let the Republicans write a sign and then we stuck it to our own backs and walked around with it. I've personally had clients in a general election that wouldn't answer the question whether or not they would be voting for Al Gore. The answer is, of course, I'm voting for Al Gore. I'm voting a straight ticket Democrat. And I think everyone should. Instead, they've run from those national candidates because the knee jerk in Texas was among Democrats is, hey, we're starting to lose to Republicans because they're painting us as being these national liberals that want to take their guns and give away all their money to people on welfare and so forth. So let's moderate and let's don't scare them off. And so they're running as a Republican light. And Republican voters and independent voters that are thoughtful, they're sophisticated enough to know that you probably don't mean what you're saying. You're just saying it to get elected. It just doesn't come across as genuine. I think what would have been a better strategy and what I would encourage any Texas Democrat on the ballot to do this cycle is to say, damn right I'm with Hillary. And you know why? Because we're going to raise a minimum wage. And we're going to make sure that kids have a safe neighborhood to live in and a safe school to go to. We're going to make sure that teachers get treated with respect. We're going to make sure that when women go to a doctor, that only her and the doctor are making decisions about her future. Not 150 old white guys in a pink building downtown. So I think that the most fertile ground for Democrats is actually pulling themselves closer to Hillary, but being very aggressive in enumerating exactly why. And not just why they're supporting her, but why everyone else should.
So what are some of the first steps that the party takes to make Texas a closer race? I got the convention coming up this week, the state convention. What do you hope, that's the kickoff for the activists. That's the 3-day Red Bull for the activists to get them ready and get them out the door and working through to November. What do you hope people are going to take away from it?
What I hope people are going to take away from it is we control our own destiny. This is not a situation where we're in the back of a taxi and someone else is driving. We've got the wheel. We've got the keys. It's up to us. And it's not enough to show up 3 days every 2 years and hoot and holler and cheer every time somebody insults the other party. You got to take it home with you. You got to live it. You got to breathe it. It's got to be part of your life. And the precursor to someone voting is they have to be registered. So you know what? Go get deputized so that you can register people in your home county. The precursor to them having the option to vote for a Democrat is I'm actually going to vote. So organize your friends, the local party, your PTA club, and get people to go vote. In Texas, as we saw in 2008, when a large number of people vote, they vote Democratic. The Republicans have risen to power almost unabated because Democrats don't vote. And they're outvoting us. In 2010, I believe the statewide straight ticket, they had an 8-to-1 advantage on us. 8-to-1. You're not going to overcome that with anything you do structurally. You're not going to overcome that with anything you do in terms of, you know, attitude and thinking positively. The only way you're going to overcome that is by it being not an every 2 year thing, but it being an everyday thing.
I just don't sense that Hillary Clinton, though, has the kind of inspirational qualities that either Obama did, even though he was also polarizing in many ways. I think that there were a lot of people that were inspired by him. I just don't sense that with Hillary. Are you sensing that, what you're seeing?
No, and I think that Senator or Secretary Clinton is a great leader, and I happen to think that she'd be a great president. But is she one that, you know, inspires the feeling of transformative leadership? I don't think so. I don't think that she has the same motivational qualities among women voters that, for instance, President Obama had among African-American voters. And I think that's one reason that she needs, a dynamic VP nominee like Julian Castro, that's young, that's optimistic, that he's living the American dream, that can inspire people, not just in Texas, but everywhere, to not just vote for one of their own, but to also vote for, a brighter future. Secretary Clinton, I think, will make a great president, but I'm sure even she would acknowledge that this is it. This is her last run, unless she gets a reelection opportunity. I think that we need to offer to Democrats, both in Texas and nationally, a glimpse at their future. Because if we can get a young, optimistic, transformative candidate for vice president to run with her, to serve 8 years with her, and then run and serve 8 years, we'll have 24 years of progressive Democratic leadership in this country. It'll make what FDR did look like peanuts. We can literally lift people out of poverty. We can overcome these waves. We can change states from red to purple to blue. We can fix policy that's hopelessly broken. We can really get after income inequality, which you can't do with one bill, and you can't do over one cycle or one presidential term or even two presidential terms. It takes a generation for us to start fixing some of these institutional deficiencies that we have, particularly as it relates to income inequality, which, quite frankly, is the seed that grows a lot of other problems for us, be it poverty, be it crime, education, incarceration. A lot of it grows from whether or not people have good jobs and can get ahead if they work hard.
Hillary Clinton, again, we opened with the fact that she said in a magazine interview, Texas is in play. How hard will you be working to make sure she's backing up that statement? Or what do you do? What can you do? She said it, but what can you do to actually see something come from it?
You know, that's a good question. She has a lot of Texans and a lot of people with experience in Texas and Texas ties running her campaign and giving her advice. Obviously, former Land Commissioner Gary Morrow and her are very close, and as President Clinton as well for, 40 years or something like that. Congressman Quayed from Laredo, who's a client of mine, is very close with both Secretary Clinton and President Clinton, has hosted both of them in Laredo at his home for fundraisers and public events. So I do think there are some Texans that are going to be talking to her. We do also have some very prominent donors, Domingo Garcia from Dallas, Eva Longoria from San Antonio, Henry Munoz from San Antonio, Alonzo Cantu from the Valley. So we have some options there for Texans that have the secretary's ear or can get to her ear. I think that can help make that case. And they're the ones that are going to have to do it. They're the ones going to have to tell her, hey, invest here. And don't throw us $2 million and say that you helped us. Come here, help us. Let's make a run at it. And, you know, Jay, back to your earlier point about moving the needle, and we hear that, and getting closer and so forth. You know, losing by two is the same as losing by 20, quite frankly, in terms of the practical implications of what happens. We need a transformative election cycle, and we're not going to get that with a U.S. senator from Virginia being the VP. If we want to turn Texas blue, we need to have Texans on the ballot that have a future, both in the state and nationally. And I hope that Secretary Clinton follows up on her statement that Julian is going to be on the short list for VP.
Is he a client list at this point? Is he one of your clients?
He is not.
Okay.
He is not.
Former client.
A little disclaimer.
I've never worked for Julian. Oh, yeah. Okay. I've definitely right. given him advice, but his you know, he and his brother, Congressman Castro Joaquin, I am friends with them. Mm-hmm. I was asked the other day, are Texas Democrats pretty much screwed until one of the Castros comes home and runs? And I said, yes. And that was the beginning, the middle, and the end of my answer. When I look around the state, I don't see a lot of other people out there trying to make their footprint larger.
I think there's a Senate race in 18 they could take a look at.
There may be one. There may be one.
I think I hear Ted Cruz is running for re-election, so.
Well, we'll see. We'll see what Ted Cruz is going to do. I think everyone at this point can confidently say that no one knows what Ted Cruz is going to do at any moment in time.
Colin Strother is a Democratic strategist, and he's certainly hoping that something comes around here in 2016.
Please, Lord.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's it this week from The Ticket. Want to hear any of our previous episodes? This one is number 47. Go to theticket2016.com. There you can subscribe to the podcast via SoundCloud, Stitcher, the new Google Play podcast section, and of course, iTunes.
And when you're on iTunes, please leave us a review. It really does help other people find our podcast. And we'd also please ask that you suggest our podcast to your friends. We'd love to boost our listenership now that the race is really kicking off.
And if you've got a suggestion for an interview or episode topic, let us know on Twitter at TheTicket2016 or by email, theticket2016@gmail.com. The Ticket is a co-production of KUT News and the Texas Tribune. KUT Managing Editor Matt Largie has been known to eat pizza with a fork and knife. And our theme music is by Ben Rue. Thanks for listening.